From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina has attracted national attention for its recent tax reforms. A top executive from the Washington-based Tax Foundation explains why the Tar Heel State stands out from the crowd. North Carolinians pay $10 billion a year in property taxes. You'll hear an analysis of where that money goes. The state unemployment rate has dipped to 4.2%, but not every county is doing that well. An NC State University expert explains some of the reasons for wide variations in employment trends statewide. And we'll examine the latest enrollment numbers for private schools and for homeschools in North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Two NC State University researchers say that the university silenced them in response to pressure from the solar energy industry in North Carolina. These researchers say that they were actually removed from government-sponsored forums when they questioned the effects of large solar facilities on North Carolina farmland. Dan Way is associate editor at Carolina Journal. He wrote the story we're talking about. He's here to explain the details. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
It's pretty amazing. Let's start first with these two who are making the allegations. Who are they?
Well, Dr. Ron Heiniger is a crop and soil scientist at the Vernon James Research and Extension Center in Plymouth, North Carolina. And Herb Eckerlin is an emeritus professor with the College of Engineering at NC State, who actually started the Solar Center out there, helped to create the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. Both of them say that they support solar energy, but want to have more research into some of the implications of the industry on North Carolina.
How did things go awry for them?
Well, they had been doing a series of consultations with counties across the state where some of these big solar projects are coming in. Obviously, the local communities don't have the same kind of resources that the big energy lobbies do. So they were looking for experts to help them understand what implications might be for the local communities with the solar explosions. So they started meeting with counties, and out of that grew this interest in having them appear to cooperative extension offices around the state to take the message to the farmers, where people were asking a lot of information about the impact on the agricultural community.
That sounds perfectly appropriate. It sounds like they were engaging in helping people understand more about what was happening in the state, and information and education campaign. So what generated what they say is a silencing effect from their university?
Well, Tom Melton, who oversees the Cooperative Extension Service, says that they received complaints from some of the extension agents in the counties. Eckerlin and Heiniger dispute that. They say they were welcomed and greeted with a lot of enthusiasm because there's a lot of people who want to know more about this industry. So they, the university also says that they received some complaints from some folks in the solar industry and from the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center, which is on the university campus. So they said as a result of that and the feeling that this wasn't an educational forum being presented and it wasn't under the auspices of the university, that they wanted to shut it down.
Were they visited, so to speak, by any particular person, or did they receive any communications in writing saying, stop what you're doing?
Yeah, interestingly enough, Dr. Heiniger, on his way to the very first meeting in Fayetteville, got a phone call from Mr. Melton saying, you can't do this. Well, at that point, it was too late. The meeting was about to take place, so they held the meeting. From all accounts, it was very successful, very well received by the community. And there was one more meeting after that in Halifax, after which they were ordered not to participate anymore. and the county extension agents were told not to allow them to have these two guys on their panels.
Do we know who specifically told them that they could not do this anymore?
Well, it was Mr. Melton.
Does he have the support, or do we know if he has the support of the higher-ups at the university, so to speak?
Well, all questions that I try to get some answers from the chancellor, and everyone I talk to, they refer me to Mr. Melton as a spokesperson, the point person on this issue. So I can only assume that, yeah, he's got the support from others.
What's been the reaction from these two gentlemen then?
Well, they're distressed. As I mentioned earlier, neither of them are opponents of solar energy. They want to have more study done, more research, so people can understand the full effect. There are decommissioning issues. There are soil issues, there are runoff issues, lots of things that people want to know more about. Even the siting where these places, these solar installations go. I mean, some of these are massive. So,
and there's a lot of farmland in North Carolina that the owners have chosen to lease their land out to solar companies. So it's not as if this is somehow an issue that really has no relationship to North Carolina. They didn't kind of pull this out of left field, so to speak. This is happening a lot in our state.
Exactly. And that's one of the concerns that Dr. Heininger has, is that as prime farmland is being gobbled up by these installations, that it could ultimately, if left unchecked and best practices aren't implemented, that the agriculture infrastructure could disappear. Causing the entire agricultural community to implode.
Agriculture being the number one industry in North Carolina.
Now, some folks tell him that's the worst case scenario, and he says, yeah, probably so, but we've seen this in other instances, as in the dairy industry. Once there were some buyouts in that industry from the government, dairy never recovered in eastern North Carolina and other places. So he's fears that long term, same kinds of things could happen with agriculture.
Dan, there has been a response from at least two state legislators to this. Tell us who they are and what they're doing.
Yeah, and there may be more. I don't know. But I do know for sure that the university told me that they had received inquiries from legislators, plural. I do know from talking to Jimmy Dixon, who represents Duplin County. He's a Republican. And Billy Richardson, who represents Cumberland County, is a Democrat. Both said they were concerned that there might be some issues of academic freedom here. There may be some issues of the university taking one-sided approach to this. So they raised questions with the university.
Do we know if they've received a response from the university?
I'm still waiting to hear back from them. Last I talked to the two lawmakers, they had not. Tom Melton says that he feels everyone got satisfactory answers from them.
Interesting. Well, these two researchers have obviously agreed to be interviewed by you for your Carolina Journal story. What is on their mind now? I mean, are they just kind of going about their business and accepting the fact that their university has told them they can't go out and talk to people about this?
I think both feel sad and maybe somewhat betrayed by the university. Ron Heininger said that the materials he's been using in these presentations was vetted, peer-reviewed by the folks in his department. No one disagreed with them. Herb Eckerlin has been a greatly honored and recognized individual in his field. And so they're kind of hurt that they're being portrayed as out of touch and ill-informed.
Now, I said at the top that there seems to be at least the feeling by some that this is happening because of the a very powerful lobby, the solar energy lobby in North Carolina. Any evidence of that, Dan?
Well, they say that they have never tried to shut down a meeting. I did ask them directly if they made complaints. They didn't answer that question. But clearly, the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State has a lot of interplay with the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. And some folks say that they're joined at the hip, actually, and they make references to Gene Nichols' Poverty Center in the same breath, comparing that to what's going on at the tech center.
Well, clearly the story is not over, and I know you're going to be following any further developments, and as those happen, you'll write about it, I'm sure. We've been talking with Dan Way. He is an associate editor with Carolina Journal. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Donna, and look forward to an expanded version in our print publication coming out soon.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has seen significant tax reform at the state level in recent years. Policy experts and politicians outside the state are taking note. Joining us now to help place North Carolina's tax reforms in perspective is Joseph Henchman. He's Vice President of Legal and State Projects at the Tax Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be back with you.
First of all, remind us, what is it about North Carolina's tax reforms in recent years that really is noteworthy?
Sure. Well, if I could put it in one word, it would be structure. Lots of other states cut taxes, lots of other states raise taxes, but what made North Carolina's reform so so special and so important is that it was a structural reform. The state really hadn't updated its tax code for decades, and of course the economy has changed. The people have changed, the direction the state was going had changed, but the tax code had just not kept up. And the reform tackled all areas of taxes in an attempt to reorient the tax system towards what makes a state competitive in today's economy.
And why is such a structural change more important than just cutting taxes?
Well, they're both important, but I think structure is important because it makes sure that you're geared up for the economy of the future, and really the economy of the present, in fact. So North Carolina's tax system before the change was very much oriented around a textile manufacturing economy, which worked for the state when the economy actually looked that way. But now the state's much more about and those still remain important sectors of the economy. But today there's also the service sector. There's the healthcare sector. There's the financial services sector. And all of those were just kind of left out of the tax code. And why that matters is because if your tax code is geared towards an economy that doesn't exist anymore, then there's a danger that you're harming additional investment and additional job creation in those new sectors. The worst example of that was and is Michigan, which essentially designed a tax code around the automobile industry. So it was very punitive to all other types of business and all other types of economic activity in order to benefit that industry and ensure that it stayed in Michigan, at least from a tax perspective. But when other economic factors led to that industry's decline and collapse, Michigan was really left with nothing. And we wanted to make sure North Carolina wasn't in that type of situation.
Now, the Tax Foundation looks at the state tax systems across the country, ranks them, and North Carolina has actually seen some tangible benefits from these changes, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it's a ranking we do annually in our State Business Tax Climate Index. It's not perfect, but it's an attempt to gauge how competitive a state's tax system is. We look at over 100 different variables in all the different types of taxes and compare them against each other. Before the reforms, North Carolina was in the bottom 10 of states, and that just represents a historical punitive tax system on investment, on wealth that just went along with a lot of North Carolina's neighbors back in the day. After the reforms, North Carolina's jumped significantly on our index, and this year is in 11th place, so from 44th up to 11th, which is the biggest jump we've actually seen in the history of our report in the 15 years we've been doing it.
We are chatting with Joseph Henchman. He is Vice President of Legal and State Projects at the Tax Foundation. We, of course, in North Carolina have been talking about this quite a bit in recent years. Are other states talking at all about what's happening in North Carolina?
They are, and I think it goes in two major tacks. One is the pressure for competitiveness. North Carolina, of course, is not the only state that's worried about its competitive environment. We may or may not have a big debate at the national level about how competitive our tax code is later this year when proposals for reforming the federal tax code come up. And in different states, I think everybody is all worried about Texas and people moving to Texas and businesses going to Texas. And that certainly was a motivating factor in North Carolina. So we see a lot of states around Texas talking about what they can do. Now, it's tough to match Texas on abolishing your income tax. Usually income taxes raise a lot of money for essential services, so you can't get rid of that completely, not without a lot of hard work. But other ways to make sure that, if you can't match Texas on income tax, what can you be competitive on? What can you do to build on a strength in the state or at least overcome a weakness to make sure that people aren't fleeing the state for tax purposes? So, for instance, Tennessee is tackling an old tax on dividends and investment they have called the Hall tax. They're going to phase that over time. Mississippi is looking at repealing franchise taxes, which are literal taxes on investment. So if you think there's not a lot of investment and capital formation going on in Mississippi, it's because they tax it pretty heavily. Louisiana is looking at structural reform. We'll see what direction they go in. They're right now at a path, and they can go for the better or for the worse, and we'll see what they do. And even Georgia, which is a state that's been pretty happy with a tax code that hasn't changed for several decades, is looking at some significant changes. So we are seeing a lot of activity all over the country.
And to some extent, are some of these people saying, well, look at the success North Carolina has had. Let's try to emulate that or find our own way to get there?
I think so. So the two big increases on our report, which again is an attempt to try to look at how states have improved their tax systems or worsened their tax systems over time, have been North Carolina and Indiana. And both of them, North Carolina and Indiana are different from other states in that they have all of the major taxes. You have property taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, corporate income taxes, not like Wyoming, which just doesn't have taxes. So you have them all in North Carolina, but they're all broad-based and low, the goal being to try to get them to apply to as many people as possible so everybody's pitching in, but at a lower rate as possible so that you're not picking winners and losers through the tax code. Instead, people are just paying what they owe. And Indiana follows the same construct. So I think a lot of states are looking at that type of structural change in order to improve their system. And what's also important about North Carolina is how broad-based the reform was for different types of people. Of course, taxes matter for individuals a lot too, not only because individuals what they buy and sell is subject to tax, but also a lot of businesses pay under the individual code. In fact, the vast majority of businesses don't pay corporate income tax. They pay through the individual code. So the reforms on the individual side, which North Carolina and Indiana have done quite a bit of, have meant a lot for small businesses.
How do taxpayers, not only in North Carolina but across the country, benefit when these various states are looking at ways to make their tax codes better?
Well, let's look at the record on North Carolina just as one example. So the overall tax change was a net revenue reduction. So it was good that the state was in a position to be able to do that because it meant everybody ended up better off. Now, some people, like a higher middle income family, maybe was only better off by a couple of dollars. But everybody ended up being better off from the low income to the high income scale. The benefit for that is that it's a little bit easier to pass it. Some states, they're just not in a revenue situation like that, and they have to make theirs to be revenue neutral or revenue positive, in which case you do have to make some hard choices. Old saying that a poker game is revenue neutral. But that doesn't mean there aren't winners and losers at the table. So some interests that get us a particular tax credit or particular tax benefit, they'll lose a lot in that type of reform. So it's a lot harder to do.
Our time remaining is short, but is there one particular thing you see in North Carolina's tax code that you would say this is what you should tackle next?
Well, North Carolina still has a franchise tax, similar to the one I mentioned about Mississippi, which is a literal tax on investment. Now, it's not as big as it is in Mississippi. It's a relatively light tax. I think maybe tackling that might be a good thing. North Carolina is one of only about a dozen states that still has that tax.
Well, one person who's going to be watching closely as North Carolina and other states deal with all of these tax issues is Joseph Henchman. He is Vice President of the Tax Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolinians pay about $10 billion a year in property taxes. That number stands out for Julie Tisdale. She's the John Locke Foundation's city and county policy analyst.
The urban areas clearly are collecting more, the rural areas less. But overall, this works out to about $1,000 per person, not per taxpayer, per person. Per year in North Carolina that we're paying in property taxes. And everybody's paying that. You're paying that if you own a home, obviously, or a business. But you're also paying if you rent. It affects your rental rate because the property owner is going to have to pay that tax. And, you know, I don't know about you, but on my list of ways to spend $1,000, giving it to the local government isn't very high. Tickets to Aruba are kind of way above that. But we're all given $1,000 a year or so in property taxes, plus all those others. Therefore, it's really important how that money's being spent. Are they spending it for things that are actually important, or things that we value as citizens? And the answer to that often is no.
One questionable area of local government spending, convention centers. Tisdale referenced a recent newspaper headline.
Raleigh Convention Center director wants to double its size. And this surprised me a little bit, because everything that I had heard indicated that the convention center was losing tons of money. So I thought, well, maybe I've got this wrong. Maybe the convention center is actually doing really well. That'd be fantastic. You know, it's doing really well. It's making money. It needs to grow. So I started to dig into those numbers a little bit. Turns out I was right, actually. The convention center, last year, revenue from events totaled about $6 million. Expenses was about $8 million. So that's a hole. And then I thought, well, maybe it's because of the way they do the accounting. In the city finances, they group together the convention center and the performing arts center. So I said, well, maybe if we look at that whole complex as a whole, maybe the picture's better. But it's not. User charges were $14 million and expenses were $17 million for that whole complex last year. And then we need to throw in $25.5 million just last year for debt service on that building. So we are deeply, deeply in the hole.
So why does Raleigh want a larger convention center?
They are busy. There's an event there almost every weekend of the year and often during the week. That's because we're subsidizing it. The Convention Center Financing Fund put in about $20 million last year. That's funding that comes from occupancy taxes, prepared food taxes. Every time you go out to a meal, you're contributing to this convention center fund.
That's Julie Tisdale of the John Locke Foundation highlighting just one example of questionable local government spending on a convention center. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's official unemployment rate has hovered around 5% for the past year or so, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. But that average statewide rate doesn't tell the story of wide variation within North Carolina. Our next guest has been looking at county-by-county data. He's been looking for reasons why some counties have unemployment rates of less than 4% while others face double-digit unemployment. Dr. Michael Walden is an economist and Reynolds Distinguished Professor at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Mitch.
So if we look at 4.7, 4.9% unemployment across North Carolina and think, oh, it looks pretty good, that doesn't tell us the whole story, does it?
It does not. And anyone who's been in North Carolina long enough knows that we do have a lot of variation in all the economic numbers, but especially unemployment. And this has been examined many times in other states, but I took a fresh look at it for North Carolina, and I found several things that people probably would shake their head and say, yeah, I understand that. A couple things they did not. The things that people would shake their head and say, yeah, that makes sense is, number one, is counties that have a higher proportion of their workers with college degrees have lower unemployment rates. And I think that's because the economy's changing. Businesses are changing, economic sectors are changing, and having a college degree helps you get a wider variety of jobs. Secondly, I found that counties that have grown faster, just in terms of raw population, have had lower unemployment rates. So right there, you get a good picture of why, for example, the Charlotte metro area and the Raleigh metro or Triangle metro have lower unemployment rates than, say, the Northeast counties or the South Central counties. Now, the couple factors that I looked at, and this is based on other research that perhaps is surprising to people, is looking at the characteristics of the workforce, particularly in terms of characteristics that might cause employers to say, you know, I'd rather not go to that county because there may be some issues. And the two things I looked at were obesity rates and a measure that tried to capture the prevalence of drug use by individuals in the county. And I found for both of those, and this is in a statistically significant sense, that they did impact county unemployment rates. That is to say, the higher the obesity rate in a county and the higher the rate of drug use, the higher the unemployment rate. And I think what the explanation for that would simply be is that certainly with drug use, that makes perhaps individuals working less reliable. I mean, some issues there. And I think there's some evidence that obesity rates maybe are related to higher healthcare costs. And of course, many businesses bear those costs. So that tells me that policies that try to reduce obesity and drug use all are not just social policies, but they're economic policies.
And you mentioned that this is statistically significant, yeah. So that we are looking at the correct cause and effect. It's not the people have no jobs, so yeah. They become more likely to use drugs or get more obese.
Well, that's a very interesting question. When I actually address in the report, you could argue that the causality, at least for those the obesity and the drug use, goes the other way. That is to say, if you're in a county where there aren't a lot of jobs, that may cause people to become despondent and may cause them to engage in activities that in the long run aren't necessarily good for them. There is a statistical way to test for that. And the conclusion of that statistical test is that the causation indeed goes from counties with higher obesity rates and higher drug use adversely affecting the employment possibilities. Now, statistical tests are statistical tests. They don't prove necessarily anything, but it looks like that's the way the causality runs. So again, if we have policies that try to reduce obesity and reduce drug use, that should have a positive influence on getting unemployment rates down.
We are chatting with Dr. Michael Walden, economist and Reynolds Distinguished Professor at North Carolina State University. We know that our General Assembly here in North Carolina has been focusing for a number of years on what's sometimes called the urban-rural divide, or trying to help the counties that, as you've described, still dealing with double-digit unemployment or much higher rates than the areas that have been succeeding. Does it look as if we do need some sort of policies that will particularly target these counties, or is this something that we can address by statewide efforts that are going to help lift all boats?
I've been here almost 40 years at NC State, and this has been an issue for every year I've been here. And I think what the state can do and what locals can do in reducing this urban-rural divide is very small, because it's really based on big forces that we can't control. For example, the demise of the textile, furniture, and tobacco industries, which were big employers in rural counties, those aren't going to come back necessarily. The fact that now employers and employees want to be in urban counties with a lot of amenities, that's where the universities are, that's where the 21st century sectors like tech and pharmaceuticals are. So I don't think state policies are going to erase this anytime soon. For example, to elevate educational attainment in a county, takes a long time. That's not something you can do overnight. Now, I do think there's some possibilities, and this is beyond what I've addressed in this report, but I've addressed in other areas. I think there's some possibilities for rural counties. For example, agribusiness. The world is changing, eating more meat. We're very good at producing meat. If we can solve those environmental problems, that may be something that rural counties can expand upon. Manufacturers who need a lot of space, which they typically do. If we could get an auto assembly plant in North Carolina, that would likely go to a rural area. And then I think that one strategy that a lot of people don't think is economic development really is attracting retirees. Retirees are on the move in the nation.
And
they have money to spend. They don't have kids to educate. They bring their pensions to Social Security. And they're moving south. And North Carolina has always been very good at attracting them. If we can bring retirees into rural counties, we have beautiful rural counties with small towns. I think that should be considered an economic development strategy.
And it also sounds as if policies on a statewide or perhaps on a regional basis that deal with obesity and drug use might have some marginal benefits for these counties that are struggling.
That's right. And I think if there's one new thing that my report illustrated is that impact. I haven't seen anything, particularly in North Carolina, that's looked at the impact of those two characteristics on unemployment rates. You're absolutely right. If we can do that at a local basis, a statewide basis, however, to convince leaders and businesses, hey, if we want to have a better economic environment in a county that maybe is struggling, those are two things, drug use, obesity, if we can get those under control, that's certainly helpful.
Beyond the policy implications, going back to the start of the interview, basically, it sounds as if one of the things we ought to keep in mind, though, is as we're looking at the unemployment rate, we need to remember that that one rate doesn't tell the whole story of North Carolina, and we have to look beyond that headline to look at what's happening in different areas, not just what's happening in the Triangle of Charlotte, but also what's happening in Gates County or right. Ashe County or all these other places.
Absolutely. And then the other thing I might mention is, of course, many people are surprised when I say this. Federal government, which is the source of all the unemployment data, puts out six different unemployment rates for the state, not quite six for all the counties. And the one that we typically quote has a very strict standard of unemployment. You have to be without a job, want a job, and have actively looked for work. And we have a lot of counties where people have just given up. They're able-bodied. They could work. They've just given up working. They don't count in the unemployment statistics. I estimate there are about 200,000 people like that in North Carolina. And this is not a North Carolina-specific issue. It's nationwide. So we always want to understand what that unemployment rate is measuring.
And those who you mentioned were in that category, are they more likely to be in the counties that have high official unemployment rates too?
I haven't looked at that, but I suspect so. And I think also an issue with those 200,000 folks is they just don't have the skills.
One of the people who keeps track of all of this information and provides interesting analysis of it is Dr. Michael Walden, economist and Reynolds Distinguished Professor at North Carolina State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It has been a banner year for school choice in North Carolina. Data recently released for the 2016-17 school year shows that more North Carolina parents are opting to educate their kids in an environment outside the traditional public school classroom. Dr. Terry Stoops has analyzed the numbers. He's here to share them with us. He is, of course, Vice President for Research, Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
You've actually written that you're going to change the name of North Carolina to the School Choice State. Why?
Well, it hasn't been claimed yet, so why not? Right. We should make ourselves a School Choice State. Well, this was a remarkable year for school choice in North Carolina. Not only did we see homeschool numbers reach close to 128,000 students, but we exceeded 100,000 students in our private schools for the first time. And this fall, we'll have over 100,000 charter school students. Not only that, we even passed a new school choice program. So I would say this year rivals those years that we passed other school choice programs in the past. This has been really, really remarkable year for school choice.
Before we get into the numbers and a little bit more about each category's growth, give us some context on this. So there are hundreds of thousands of kids across North Carolina who are school-aged, perhaps more than that. What percentage really are now being educated outside of that traditional schoolroom?
Well, we're looking at around 17%, and that is mainly just an estimate. There are some homeschool groups that believe that there's even a larger homeschool community that's not being counted. So possibly as high as 20% of individuals, of school-age children in this state, are being educated in a home, private, or charter school. And, you know, it also is important to remember that there are school districts that offer school choices, such as magnet schools or other choice programs like they have in Winston-Salem-Forsyth. So the actual number of students that are taking advantage of choices is much larger than just the 17 to 20% that are in home, private, or charter schools.
That's a really interesting point. It just seems like more and more people, Terry, seem to be understanding that they do have choices if they've decided that that traditional classroom doesn't work for them. Why is it people seem to be, A, understanding there's choice, and B, taking advantage?
Well, we have more choices, and it's important to note that the Opportunity Scholarship for low-income kids and the Disability Grant for special needs students didn't exist 6 or 7 years ago. So we have more opportunities for parents to go to private schools. We lifted the cap on charter schools, increasing the number significantly. So we're having more seats in charter schools available than ever before. And homeschooling is a better option now for a lot of parents now that the online communities have such a rich storehouse of materials and assistance for homeschoolers. It makes it a lot easier to homeschool these days than it did before the internet existed or these co-ops that many communities have were formed.
Let's talk more about charter schools. Folks may not realize those are public schools, charters, but they're a little bit different from the traditional district school. How so?
Well, they're freed from many of the regulations that are imposed on district schools. Now, they still have to give state tests. That's an important part, and they still have to meet certain requirements, but they're freed from some of the regulations regarding teacher certification and some of the other things that many district schools feel is an impediment to providing a high-quality education. Just 5 years ago, we had half the number of charter school students than we do today, which is absolutely remarkable and a real testament to the General Assembly and Governor McCrory not only lifting the cap on charter schools, but allowing more seats in existing charter schools to be offered to students because demand remains strong. Under one estimate, there are 30,000 students that would like to go to a charter school and cannot.
Help us understand how it is you enroll a child in a charter school.
Well, it's just as easy as filling out paperwork to go to a charter school. And any parent can apply to go to a charter school, and they'll get a seat in a charter school unless the number of applicants exceeds the number of seats. And then they have to use a random method such as a lottery to determine who gets in. So there's no creaming of students. There's no picking and choosing. In most charter schools, because demand is so strong, they have to use a lottery to choose who gets in.
Homeschooling I find really fascinating, Terry, because it turns out that there seems to be a close-knit, tight-knit community of homeschool parents in our state, and there's at least one, probably more organizations that help them find resources and things like that. But there was a time when homeschooling was primarily for folks who wanted religious education for their kids, but that is far from what it is today.
That's for sure. We're seeing a lot of parents that are left of center ideologically or politically go to homeschooling. And people homeschool for many different reasons. That original homeschool community really disliked the secular curriculum that was being taught in district schools. But now parents are pulling their kids into homeschools for any number of reasons, safety reasons, sometimes proximity. Sometimes they're just tired, especially in these larger counties, of seeing their child assigned to schools year after year, moving around so much. It takes a real toll on parents and kids. So there's any number of reasons why they chose to homeschool. And the fact that the economy is great in North Carolina means more mothers and fathers can stay home and actually homeschool. So that's another positive.
Is that possibly the reason that we're also seeing an uptick in the private school enrollment?
I definitely think that's part of it. The economy being strong and more parents being able to afford a private school tuition. We've seen an increase in the number of private schools, so that's going to increase the number of students. But I think that the Opportunity Scholarship Program and the Disabilities Grant are really pushing those numbers up. And I would say that that is the reason why we have seen the private school numbers exceed 100,000 students for the first time.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned that there is a new choice that North Carolina has. What is it?
These are education savings accounts, and these are basically accounts that parents can take a set amount of money, $9,000, and distribute it to any number of education or service providers. So let's say that you have a special needs student, and it is only for special needs kids at this point, and they need therapy a couple times a week. You can use this education savings account to pay the tuition at a private school, pay for the therapy, and then pay for any sort of instructional materials that the parent would think that that child needs to be successful in school. So in other words, rather than just being able to pay for tuition, they can pay for any number of qualifying expenses.
Does that program somehow relate to the disability grant program, or are they separate?
They're separate right now, and I think eventually we'll see the disability grant be folded into the education savings account. And we're not going to see the education savings account until 2018-19. So they're going to do some planning for the first year because it does require some oversight. You have all these expenses being paid for by the state. So they're going to set it up for the first year, and then it'll be ready in the second year.
And lastly, Terry, we know we've got a lot of public charter schools in the pipeline that are in the process of getting ready to open. So does that really portend even higher numbers?
It really does. The 100,000 student estimate we're seeing for this year is really just the tip of the iceberg. Once additional schools come online next year, we're going to see another 10 or 15,000 students added to the rolls.
Dr. Terry Stoops with the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.